This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people can't comprehend why someone would become a suicide bomber. A recruiter, a trainer, and three Palestinian suicide bombers whose missions failed in Israel speak for themselves in a new documentary called Suicide Bombers, which will be shown tomorrow night on many PBS stations as part of the series Wide Angle. The men were interviewed in Israeli prisons. The documentary was written and directed by my guest Tom Roberts, who also conducted the interviews. He lives in London. The film was produced by Israel Goldvicht, who lives in Jerusalem. We'll hear from Goldvicht a little later. Let's start with an excerpt of an interview that Tom Roberts recorded with an 18-year-old named Muhammad Abu Tayyun about why he had wanted to become a suicide bomber. Tayyun backed down just before he was supposed to detonate his bomb.
I want to become a martyr. I don't want this life. I want to be with God, to enjoy the second life. I want to go to paradise where there is happiness and joy, where there are no problems. There I get all I want. I get to be with the 70 virgins. Here our life is full of problems. We Palestinians prefer to die, just kill ourselves, rather than live this worthless life. Our life is worthless. We are hollow bodies leading a pointless life. Israelis enjoy their life. They go out at night, they have cafes and nightclubs. They travel all over the world. They go to America and Britain. We can't even leave Palestine.
Tom Roberts says it was difficult to convince Israeli authorities to grant permission to interview the failed suicide bombers, but once he was given permission, he was able to select from a large number of prisoners. I asked him how he chose the men featured in the documentary.
The majority of people that we spoke to, we asked if we could interview them immediately after their interrogation was complete, so that they were in effect fresh from the field, that they had not spent a long time in prison thinking about what they'd done and perhaps reorganizing their thoughts or retelling the story or manipulating the story, but in fact it comes straight out of interrogation. We subsequently followed up those initial interviews with quite an extensive range of contacts. So we did secondary and tertiary interviews with the same individuals, and we found, of course, they said the same things, although with less intensity than the first interview, so that we know that we didn't have a distortion in terms of their point of view.
Tom, let's talk about some of the people that you interviewed. The first suicide bomber interviewed on this documentary is Muhammad Abu Tayyun, an 18-year-old who entered Israel with a bag full of explosives, but then wavered and returned home before, deciding against detonating, mm-hmm. and he was arrested several days later. Why did he want to be a suicide bomber, or a martyr, as he would call it?
Well, I think that he is representative of a very large number of them. A young man who is going to school, experiences the occupation, is aware that to be a shaheed, that is a martyr, is an exalted position. Girls are said to gather around the poster of the new shaheed and giggle and talk and admire. Everyone speaks in hushed terms about these individuals. So he certainly felt that maybe for nationalist reasons he should do something like this. I don't believe that he really, deep down inside, actually was so caught up in the ideology that he really wanted to do it and was driven to do it. I think that he played with the idea, and then, of course, he tells the story about how when he mentioned to his life's love, a woman, a young girl he had known for like 7 or 8 years and intended to marry, she was so appalled by the prospect that she became angry and cut off her contact with him. This curiously led him to, I think, probably become depressed. I don't know quite how he responded in emotional terms, but certainly it accelerated his decision to become a suicide bomber. Then all the ideologies and other elements that are used to buttress these people and get them on the mission were put into play.
Before the mission, he made his video declaration of martyrdom. What did he have to do on this video?
Well, generally, I mean, I think we've all seen them on the news. Are often given a piece of paper to read, which is a tract, a political tract, justifying your actions, proclaiming your belief in Allah and the importance of martyrdom operations. It then goes on to say that you're doing this, you know, in retaliation for X or Y, and calling on your colleagues to continue these kind of actions. It's a self-justifying thing, but it has another very important mechanism. It's very difficult, of course, for any individual to wrap themselves with explosives and press the trigger. In Palestinian society, the social structure is very tight. You live amongst your family and friends, and there's little opportunity to travel and families, and the community is very, very close. And what happens is that when you appear and you give this declaration, you effect are called a living martyr. That is an individual who is in effect already dead, even though your heart is beating. And once you've made that declaration, it is socially impossible for you to back out of it. It's kind of like they've slammed the door and you have no alternative but to carry out the operation.
Why couldn't he do it? What was the attack supposed to be? And why did he decide at the last minute that he just couldn't go through with it?
As I recall, he was going to target a bus, go one of the typical bus bombings, get on a very crowded bus and press the button. In actual fact, I think he was a confused young man who was there to carry out this mission more for psychological reasons than for political or religious ones. Now, I went to visit his house. He lived in a refugee camp outside of Nablus called Balata. And it was clear that his family had some affluence. His father had been a construction company owner. He'd done small projects like municipal swimming pools and things of that sort. And as I looked around the house, I saw two pictures on the wall of what looked like to be a grandfather figure who looked down in a very stern and very rigid way amongst at this family. I later discovered, in fact, it was photographs of his father, and I watched his father very carefully, and I found him to be a tremendous autocrat. His wife seemed to be in fear of him. His kids jumped to his order. And one can imagine that Abu Tayyum was a young man who felt he had very much something to prove to his father, an element of I will be respected if I carry out this mission. I think there were a lot of psychological reasons. The girlfriend and the father add that to the wider political the general environment he was in. And he was motivated to go do this. But in his heart, I don't think he had the courage, and I don't think he had, if you will, the rigidity of thinking, the narrowness of thinking that made it possible for him to push that button.
Well, one of the things he tells you in the interview is that he thought, what if I end up killing Israelis who actually favor peace? And he decides that, there might be people who were killed who are pro-peace, and he wouldn't feel good about that. And he offers that as one of the reasons why he couldn't go through with it.
Well, I think undoubtedly that was part of the reasoning or part of his, I think, justification. I think, in fact, he knows who he's talking to in this interview, and he's also just been interrogated, so he's trying to put the best possible light on the reason he didn't go through with it. And he's deeply shamed by his failure. You can see that, the way he holds his head, the way he tries to say that, of course, God decided he was not going to be a bomber, and therefore he was made to be confused by God. In other words, it wasn't him who was confused, and it wasn't him that should be shamed, or he suffered the accusations of being a coward. He just couldn't quite do it because God was preventing him from doing it. And I think deep down, he was probably more decent an individual, ultimately, than someone who can take that extra step. And that's not to justify or excuse it, but that's to understand that the ideology that is preached, that there are thousands of men who just are desperate to go do this and blow themselves up, is actually propaganda. And there are actually very few individuals who really, truly want to do this.
So what do you think? If he is released at any point and goes back home, what would his reputation be? Would he be considered a coward? Would he be punished by his own community for not having followed through on his pledge to become a suicide bomber?
I think that's very unlikely. I don't think he would be treated. He certainly wouldn't be treated as a hero. He was a failure in terms of the ideology and the propaganda, and therefore they don't really want to call attention to that. It's easier if you just forget about him and make no fuss or noise. So I don't think he would have any great difficulty, and I certainly don't think he had any justification to fear that he would be harmed on his return. I don't think there's any evidence that failed suicide bombers go back and are executed or killed or assaulted.
Is the fact that he couldn't go through with it taken into account in his sentencing?
Well, yes. I mean, they can't sentence suicide bombers who are successful, and those who...
True. But, yeah. I mean, is there this element of, well, maybe you're not so bad because you decided against it at the last minute?
The sentence that a failed suicide bomber receives he will get about 15 to 17 years in prison. If a suicide bomber failed for technical reasons, otherwise they attempted to press the button and failed, they would get a higher sentence. And those who have been successful in terms that they've sent other people to carry out, they built the bomb and organized the trip and sent other people to kill, and that trip was successful, will serve a life sentence for every individual that was killed in the operation. So there are people in Israeli prisons with sentences of 800 years or 1,200 years. In that sense, Abu Tayyun would get a sentence of 15 to 18 years, and that would be relatively lenient.
Let me ask you about two other interviews that you did for this documentary. You interviewed two men who recruit suicide bombers and build the bombs. Israel, would you describe the bus bombing that these two men were behind?
Well, it's bus number 37 in Haifa. It was populated by young people. Quite a lot of them are school teenagers and so on. And the operation started in the city of Hebron in the West Bank, which is quite far from Haifa. And they recruited somebody who agreed to do the mission, but then changed his mind. So they picked up somebody else, and a truck, Palestinian truck driver, we were told, with an Israeli ID card, i.e. somebody who lives within either Greater Jerusalem or within the Green Line, took him to Haifa, and he went to this bus and exploded, and 17 people were killed, right? Am I right, Tom?
17 were killed and 50 injured. I think 9 were under the age of 18. And it occurred after a lull, so it came as a big shock to the Israelis when it took place.
Now, one of these two men that you interviewed recruited the bomber, and the other built the bomb and prepared the bomber. These two men that we're talking about, what was their motivation? Why were they so deeply committed to killing Israelis?
I think you have to start, to answer that question, you have to start from a slightly different perspective, which is to look at the difference between the suicide bomber, the actual button pusher, if you will, and those who send him. Those who send him are, at least in our experience, very, very committed individuals who believe deeply in the ideology, who are politically active, who see themselves as warriors, great warriors fighting the Israeli state. But I think in the end, their hearts are really filled with hatred. And if you stay to the end of the film, you hear Majdi, who tells a story at the age of 12, that when he was at the age of 12 coming back from school, he was confronted by an Israeli border patrolman who, Majdi claims, slapped him across the face for no reason whatever, and sought, many years later, sought revenge for the humiliation of that. Now, how much of that slap was in his own mind and how much he contributed to it and what actually happened at that point, you know, we'll never know. But Majdi's heart is there's no question, is full of hatred and anger.
Now, the recruiter you spoke to tells suicide bombers that they will be rewarded in paradise for their actions. What does the recruiter tell his recruits about the rewards they will get in paradise?
Well, they're very, very extensive. I mean, everyone seems to focus on the 72 virgins that the shaheed, the martyr, will be given once he gets to paradise. I'm not quite sure what happens to the female suicide bombers, but in fact, there are many other rewards, and I think one of the most significant ones is that the ideology, or if you will, the religious fundamentalism, preaches that 70 members of the suicide bombers will get a free ticket, an automatic absolution of any sins, and they will automatically go to paradise. So the suicide bomber can look forward to this luxurious, wonderful life of sexual ecstasy, surrounded by brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins and nephews, all of which he knows that because of his actions, they're guaranteed to make it to paradise. So you have a replication, if you will, of the Arab family, of the extended family in paradise. And then when you hear them describe the kind of world they're going to be in, rivers flowing of non-alcoholic wine or of milk and honey and fruit juice and water and so forth, you begin to realize that what they're describing is the idea of what paradise would be for a desert or nomadic people.
But what, one more point, if I may.
Yeah.
The fact is that those who recruited them, when they were asked by Tom about why aren't you yourself volunteering, so they do talk about doing it one day, but they talk about themselves as the seed, as those who need to stay alive to continue, you know, the struggle. And experts will tell us, told us actually, that you won't find members of family members of leaders of the Palestinian groups who are participating in it as members, as suiciders.
What did you learn from the person you interviewed who actually built bombs about how the suicide belts are designed?
Well, it's on one level very, very simple technology. It's a small, usually a plywood construction that you can use other materials with a thin layer of very high explosive, plastic explosive. And on top of that are piled nuts and bolts, nails, and things of that sort, so that when the blast takes place, these the shrapnel rips out, made very thin and worn around the waist. And the technology is simple. You need a detonator, you need a switch. That's relatively all you need. It's a very simple kind of thing. They rarely make them so that they wear them front and back, so sometimes they're mounted on the back. And as he explains quite clearly, that the simple instructions you're to receive is when you get on the bus, if the majority of people are behind you, you turn your back so that if you have wearing a backpack, it explodes in that direction. In other words, you face the bomb in the direction where the majority of people are, whether it's on the front or back, to carry out the greatest number of casualties. In a confined space, this weapon is truly devastating, and it tears people to shreds, really, and arms, legs are ripped off, and the shrapnel can do very, very severe damage. The blast wave itself is enough to kill. Even if you aren't hit by the shrapnel, the blast wave will rupture internal injuries and internal organs, rather, and cause very, very, very severe injuries. So in a small, confined place, if you do it on the street corner, the casualty levels will be much lower. So they need a confined space, a pizza shop or a bus, something of that sort.
And the suicide bombers are told that they should enter, if they're bombing a bus, that they should enter the bus full of peace and tranquility so that they don't draw attention to themselves.
And it's not painful at all. I mean, it's like a needle.
Right. They're told that it won't be painful.
At all.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think that's probably the case. I mean, this explosive is so severe and so instantaneous that the bomber is torn to pieces and dies an instantaneous death. So, you know, but I mean, you're right. They're told in religious language, you know, and enter with peace and tranquility because you're one step away from going to paradise. That you're about to carry out God's mission, and so there are reports of suicide bombers observed just before they hit the switch with a big smile on their face. I don't know if that's true, but I've heard reports of that sort. And one can imagine that if you really, really submit to the ideology, that you may well convince yourself that you're about to take the trip of your life.
Well, in fact, one of the teenaged failed suicide bombers, somebody who had second thoughts about it, tells you that one of the reasons why he wanted to do it in the first place is that he saw two martyrs with smiles on their faces.
Precisely.
Dead martyrs, yeah.
The interesting thing about Bilal, that's who you're referring to, you mentioned as a would-be suicider. I've personally come to the conclusion, this is a personal judgment, that Bilal never really was a suicide bomber. He reacted to an event in the street, as a young man might do, seeing two individuals who were shot in a confrontation with Israeli troops. We don't know the circumstances or what really happened. He felt a sense of outrage, went to people he knew that could organize these. And one of the things he did say, and we do point out in the film, is that he said to them, quick, can we do it very quickly? Can we do it speedily? Because I may change my mind. He wasn't really truly an individual who had absorbed and believed in all this. It was an instantaneous reaction, virtually. And had there been some delay, I think, before he carried out his mission, he never would have gotten that far. As it was, when he got there, he just decided he wasn't going to do this and didn't believe in it. And to this day, he's different from the others. He does not believe in it. He doesn't support it. He doesn't want to talk about politics. He realizes he made a mistake and wants to get out of Israeli prison and leave the area, leave the country.
In fact, he didn't grow up in Israel. He was born in Kuwait, grew up in Jordan, and, you know, was already a boy when his family moved to a village on the West Bank.
Exactly right, and I think that, you know, there are many different elements that make the suicide bomber who he or she is. And of course, one of those is the social experience. One of those is the life inside the West Bank or in Gaza. It's a very difficult life. There was an intifada before where the young men of the community rose up and effectively overthrew their elders and carried out this low-intensity campaign against the Israelis. Then you had eight, 9 years of the Oslo peace process, which gave the Palestinians ultimately very, very little. They got very little reward for this process. And although it was relatively quiet, it was a time of great frustration for both sides. Both sides were enormously frustrated. They couldn't progress this peace process much further. And then the extremely violent Second Intifada. And I think if you grew up in those conditions and that's all you know, you are ripe for the ideologies that are used to recruit suicide bombers.
And the teenagers today who are becoming suicide bombers are that generation that grew up during the First Intifada and the second.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Roberts and Israel Goldvick made the documentary Suicide Bombers. It will be shown on the PBS Wide Angle series tomorrow night.